From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For the activist Tim DeChristopher, the Utah desert gave him perspective. The sense of space deepened his love of wilderness and inspired his act of civil disobedience in 2008 when he disrupted a government land lease auction by submitting some bogus bids. DeChristopher went to prison for his actions, and even there, the Utah wilderness offered a frame of reference. A massive desert, he says, makes you realize how small you are, and that can be liberating. So, doing time, he says, not that big of a deal. Tim DeChristopher has been released after serving that sentence, and today in the program, he's joining us. We'll talk about doing time, about how his perspective has changed over the years, about activism, but also his personal life, his identity, his sense of God. Tim DeChristopher today, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. By now, you've heard the setup for Tim DeChristopher's story of how he made his way inside the Salt Lake City offices of the Bureau of Land Management, December 2008, and disrupted a government land lease auction. You know he spent 2 years in prison for his act of civil disobedience. It was time spread out over 4 states, 5 different institutions. And you probably know now that he's been formally released. In fact, just last week, on Earth Day, in fact. Today in the program, Tim DeChristopher is joining us to talk about that experience, the lessons he's learned along the way about climate change, social justice, also about what he learned about himself. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Tim DeChristopher is joining us here. He was released from a halfway house, as I said, last week. He's on probation for the next 3 years. Starting this fall, he plans to attend Harvard Divinity School. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
So this is going to be such a weird, clumsy way to – what was prison like? That is the question I wanted to say. But in this sense, I mean, because I've heard you talk about how you had time to exercise and to walk and to read. It was a time that lent itself, you said, to introspection. Mm-hmm. So would it be a clumsy thing to say, Tim, that doesn't really sound all that bad?
I think that's okay to say.
Yeah.
It wasn't really all that bad. It wasn't as bad as I had expected or as bad as I had feared. And it wasn't horrible. You know, like a lot of people say, oh, was it too horrible? It wasn't horrible at all. It was frustrating. It was boring.
What was frustrating?
Having other people have control over your life.
Yeah.
The guards have almost complete control over the inmates' lives. And the guards are some of the lowest class people I've ever met in my life. You know, so it's frustrating to have stupid people in control of your life. But, you know, outside of that, it certainly wasn't horrible. You know, one of the things that people have said to me over the last week or so is, oh, it's such a shame that you lost 2 years of your life.
Yeah.
It's too bad that you lost 2 years of your life. And they keep saying that phrase. And I've had to think about that and say, I didn't lose 2 years of my life. I lived 2 years of my life in a very different situation than I was used to. And that was a tremendous learning experience in a lot of ways. You know, I lived those 2 years of my life with one of the most oppressed populations of people in our society. And I learned a lot from that. I learned a lot about a lot of different social justice issues, and I think in some ways learned to see the world from a different perspective.
Did you spend a lot of time just talking to the fellow inmates?
Absolutely. I mean, I'd say that was like the biggest chunk of my time. You know, I think a lot of the people there just needed to be heard. You know, just needed to tell their story. Yeah, and to vent a lot. You know, a lot of people there, you know, were poorly educated and had this sense of injustice about the way the world worked, certainly about the way that our federal justice system worked, and were very eager to learn more about how that system really worked, about how our political system worked, that sort of thing. So I had a lot of conversations like that with folks.
Did you ever come to a point where you thought maybe you had more insight into how injustice, social injustice works in this sense? That did you come to think, oh, this is about race or this is about class or I think it's more about power. I mean, surely you worked through all of those things in your mind.
Yeah. And I think it's a little bit of all of that.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it is about class. You know, if I had to pick one above the other.
Class rises above?
Yeah, it would be class. You know, Glenn Greenwald had a great book called With Liberty and Justice for Some, about how we have a two-tier justice system in this country. And the dividing line that he drew that separated those two tiers of our justice system was whether someone's actions promote that elite ruling class and help that elite ruling class, or whether they threaten to undermine the power and the monopoly that ruling class has on power. And the people whose actions might undermine that monopoly that the ruling class has, they get locked away for a long time. The people whose actions, regardless of what the law says, the people whose actions promote that concentration of power get away with it time and time again.
I wonder if you've been very clear about showing your appreciation for those who have supported you along the way.
Yeah.
You've been profoundly moved, for example, by the Unitarian Church and mm-hmm. Peaceful Uprising, those people. We're talking about people who are of a certain race, certain level of affluence. And surely they're your people. You're still your kindred. But I'm wondering if there's ever a time since then that you've thought about seeking out some of the people that were more related to those who were in prison with you. Does that make sense? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Do you feel kind of white guilt, I guess, maybe is how I want to boil it down. Maybe not quite that way.
I don't know if I feel white guilt, but I feel frustration with being in a community of white privilege. And that's something that I had kind of started drifting towards before I got locked up. Once I knew that I was going to go in prison, I think my mind was already moving in that direction.
Yeah.
But certainly after having experienced that, you know, it's frustrating to be in a community of people that have largely been comfortable and haven't had to fight that system and haven't directly felt the impacts of it. You know, most of the people like in my church community and that kind of thing were shocked as I went through the legal process every step of the way, where the judge said, I can't talk about this, you know, where we can't bring this up, or the judge said certain things to the jury. They were shocked every step of the way. Oh, how could this work? How could this work? And that was largely because they had never been close to anyone who went through that process. And one of the things that I learned very clearly when I was in prison was that any injustices seen in my case, any outrage that people had towards the way the system was working in my case, was not unusual. Like the injustice in my case was not unusual at all. That's the status quo. That's the way that the system works. And so I have felt more connection to those oppressed populations. You know, something that folks started saying to me when I first got back to Salt Lake and first got back into my church community. That's one of the few things I was able to do when I was at the halfway house was go back to church on Sundays. Some of the folks in that community would say things like, well, what kind of people are in the halfway house? Are they nonviolent people like you, or are they real felons? And I was like,
trying to make a distinction between
you.
And I
was like, well, I'm a felon, you know, and you know, the vast majority of felons are people like me. You know, the people that I met in prison were very normal people. It's the same kind of people I met everywhere else. I think that's the consequence of mass incarceration. You know, as we keep putting millions and millions more people in prison, you know, it's not because human nature is changing. It's because we're changing the laws that allow us to lock up normal people. And even my minister there at Unitarian Church, he said, you know, we got to push a campaign to get you a pardon so that you don't have to live like a felon for the rest of your life. And that struck me, and I was like, what does that mean, to live like a felon for the rest of my life? And I realized that what that means is living with all those restrictions on our rights that felons have to deal with for their entire life, even after they've served their sentence. You know, all that segregation that they have to deal with, all that discrimination that they have to deal with. And I thought, you know, I'm not okay with leaving that population behind.
Yeah.
And that's when I decided that I didn't want a pardon. And I told him not to work for any kind of presidential pardon, because I feel like if we as a society are going to accept that there's this second class of people who are always going to be defined by their mistakes, and this second class of people who are never going to have access to rights, then you're going to have to accept that people like me are part of that class.
Yeah. So I did wonder if Tim, at one point, even though it was, I mean, you didn't feel threatened necessarily in any way in prison. You were able to do things that were, you know, read and be introspective and all those kinds of things. But surely there had to be low points. Or I'm wondering, was there a particular low point for you in prison?
When I went to isolation was a pretty low point.
Yeah. Let's explain that.
About halfway through my sentence in, I believe, March of last year, I got sent to isolation because I sent an email to a friend of mine regarding a company that had donated to my legal defense fund, and I'd heard a rumor that they were cutting all their U.S. manufacturing jobs and shipping those overseas. And so I sent this email to my friend saying, you know, see if you can find out anything about this. See if you can find out if it's true. And on my part, I'm going to write a letter to the owner and ask what's going on with this. And in that letter, I'll threaten to give away the money and speak out against them.
And there's the word threaten.
Right. And that set off some red flag somewhere. And so I was called over, and the lieutenant said, oh, I'm getting these requests from Washington to say I got to lock you up because you're threatening people. And I was like, you've got the copy of the email right there in your hand. You can clearly see that I'm not threatening anyone. And he said, but you use the word threat. And I said, well, I could have said it looks like there's a threat of rain. It doesn't mean I'm going to hurt anybody. And, you know, finally, after this Kafka-esque conversation, he said, well, when I get these requests from Washington, I've got to do something about it to make it look like I'm taking it seriously.
What does that mean? The request from who's Washington? Who's that? What does that mean? Do you know?
Well, that's where a lot of the confusion came from in this, because when he first called me into this room, he said, "Oh, I'm getting these calls from a congressman in Washington D.C."
Yeah.
And then he kind of blabbered on, and he's this very blustery guy from Texas that was clearly trying to intimidate me. And as the conversation went on, he was referring to like BOP requests from Washington, Bureau of Prisons.
Yeah.
And then at one point he said the Central Intelligence Agency was calling him, and I was like, wait a minute, why would the CIA be involved in this? And he's like, oh no, not the CIA, it's the Central Terrorism Agency. And once I got the paperwork, it turned out to be the counterterrorism unit of the Bureau of Prisons. It's one of those countless terrorism agencies that developed after 9/11 in all the different federal agencies. So it was the Bureau of Prisons' own federal agency there. And so I didn't question him on the congressman after he let me out. He said, oh, no, there was no congressman involved. And so I don't know whether that was true or not. Or whether it was just this blustery bureaucrat that wanted to sound important. But
the result of that is that you were isolated.
Yeah, the result was he said, I've got to do something about it to make it look like I'm taking it seriously, so I got to lock you up. And so they threw me into an isolation cell.
What's that like?
Well, it's where
I imagine it from the movies. It can't be as bad as that, or is it?
No, I don't think it is as bad as the movies. I mean, I don't think anything in the movies about prison is realistic.
Yeah.
But it was a very big change from where I was at. You know, I was in a minimum security prison at that point, where I could walk around, I could walk the track outside, I could exercise, that sort of thing. Into a cell where I was in a 8x10 cell, 24/7. Had no windows, you know, couldn't see the outside, couldn't tell what time it was, you know, just fed through a slot in the door, stayed in that cell all the time with one other person. There was two bunks in there, and the other person in there was kind of an unstable guy that was breaking down, and He was crying at night and that sort of thing. And the big difficulty for me was that I really had to start shutting myself off from other people in there. The soundtrack of that isolation unit is people losing their mind. The second day that I was in there, the guy on the other side of the wall lost his mind. I mean, started screaming, spent hours screaming, banging his head against the wall, banging on the door. And I just kind of had to shut myself off from that. You know, just
singing,
kind of,
praying,
just kind of turned inward and said, like, I can't feel that right now. Like, I can't have empathy for this person right now because I need to take care of my own psychological well-being. And I think that's the part that really would have got to me after a while, that closing myself off to other people. I think if I had had to do that for an extended period of time, it would have had a serious effect. And I
just want to say that's your weak spot. Like, everything that I've read about you and heard about you is – I mean, you even said this, and I wanted to get to this in a moment, but I may as well bring it up now. One of the things you've talked about in terms of why you want to protect wilderness is that it's not just about or not even about the animals or the land, the plants, that for you this is about human interactions.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is your weak spot.
I think it's my strength.
Yeah.
I really do.
Better put.
Yeah.
Explain that, though, because you had to detach from this sense of empathy, and that's what you're about, is relating to human beings.
Right. And I'm glad that that was only a temporary thing.
Yeah.
At one point when I was being moved around in there, they put me in this cell that was kind of in a hallway, and I saw one of the guys I knew from the minimum security facility that had been in there for a few months. Mm. And he was really a stable, well-respected guy, one of the most respected guys in the facility. And he said that it was around 50 days that he went crazy. And he lost it after 50 days and just broke down. And he was somebody that was in there, had been put in isolation for no cause. Somebody had ratted on him. And then the investigation turned out that he had nothing to do with it. And the guy who ratted on him had lied. And yet they wouldn't let him back into the general population because now the guy who ratted on him was afraid that there would be retribution. And so they kept him in isolation just indefinitely. And he was put into isolation right before Christmas. And there's extremely limited contact with friends and family in the isolation unit. He wasn't able to get a message out to his family for the first 21 days that he was in there, and that included Christmas and New Year's. He's got two young kids, and they just had no idea what was going on with him during the holidays.
I wonder, what were you like if you think about, you know, I guess the question is, how did you change? You know, how did you change? So if you were to think about the Tim DeChristopher that went into prison, how did you come out? What was the part of you that was the most? Because you've talked about it as a growth experience, but if you could distill it, even if that's possible, what changed about you, do you think?
I think I certainly got thicker skin. I think I got a better understanding of the nature of power, and how that works. One of the things that really impressed me and had a big impact on me about prison was actually the amount of control that the inmates had. I think really one of the fundamental rules of prison is that you have power over that which you take responsibility for. And the inmates, whether consciously or not, take as much power as they can over their situation. I think in part because there is a limited amount of control they can have over their situation. So those areas where they can influence it, they place a really high value on. And in order to do that, they take responsibility for their surroundings, for their society. Mm-hmm. When I was first put into the federal prison in Inglewood, came in with nothing, And the prison officials gave me a jumpsuit that fit poorly and a pair of slippers and a bed number. And they said, okay go. And then the other inmates came over and they showed me where that bunk was. They gave me clothes that fit well. They gave me, you know, shorts and shoes and all kinds of that stuff. They gave me food. They gave me, you know, coffee mug and all the stuff that I needed. Took me on a tour of the whole facility, explained how everything works, you know, how the food line worked and all that kind of stuff. All of that came from the inmates who, whether consciously or not, have this sense of this is our world now. Yeah. And this is the way we want it to look. And, you know, some of that, sometimes that is enforced, you know, through violent means and that sort of thing. But it is this conscious sense that this is our society, and in any way that we can influence it, we want to do that.
You know, I guess part of me was going to ask you if there's anything I know you don't regret doing what you did. That's clear. But is there anything about the experience you regret? Because it seems like, you know, the Tim DeChristopher went into prison was defiant. I think the Tim DeChristopher's come out remains defiant in some ways, but you also seem humbled by the experience, or if not the experience anyway, about the people that you met. Is that right?
Yeah. And, you know, to me, it doesn't seem like I've changed that much.
Yeah.
You know, several other people have had that comment that I seem calmer or, you know, something like that.
Yeah. You're not seeing it?
No, I don't see it. I mean, I feel as defiant as ever. You know, I mean, if anything, my experience in prison made me more radical and more committed to social justice.
I want to talk about your plans to go to divinity school and to God, talk about God, your perceptions of God through all of this. But let's take a break first.
Okay.
We'll come back to that. Tim DeChristopher is with us. He was recently released from Salt Lake City halfway house after serving 21 months in federal prison. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the activist Tim DeChristopher. He was recently released from a Salt Lake City halfway house after serving 21 months in federal prison. So I've just got to ask you. So we were talking about off air. Just you said this 20 seconds ago. So you spent – wait a minute. Say it again. You spent yesterday tooling around the Salt Flats with Neil Young.
Yeah. I got a call a few days ago that Neil Young has this 1959 Lincoln Continental that is converted to run half on electricity and half on a biodiesel generator. And he's been taking this road trip across the country and making a documentary about it. And the premise of the documentary is that he's picking up these quote-unquote hitchhikers. But the hitchhikers he's picking up are people like Daryl Hannah and you know, climate activists and things and climate scientists.
Yeah.
And so the film is really about climate change. And that seems to be the big thing that Neil Young is focused on now. And so Daryl Hannah had told him about my story, and I ended up meeting him out at the Salt Flats yesterday, and he picked me up, and we rode around and discussed what he's been doing, discussed what I've been doing.
You're a fan, I guess, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely, and it was a very surreal experience. I mean, the Salt Flats are surreal on their own.
It's
but
true.
To be in the Salt Flats in a 1959 Lincoln Continental with Neil Young was even more surreal.
You're planning on going to Harvard Divinity School in the fall. And the obvious question is why? I mean, how is it that – I mean, you know, your path forward, Tim, could have been more activism, which it will be, of course. Could have been climate research. Why Divinity School?
Well, I see it as an extension of my previous activism. For me, it's not a change in direction. It's just the next step on that path. And it's something that I started thinking about seriously when I was in that period between the auction and when I got convicted, when I was traveling around the country as an activist, and I found that there were certain parts of it that I was good at.
Yeah.
And I found at the same time that the world of professional activism didn't necessarily have an outlet for those skills that I seemed to be good at. I found I was looking at things on a holistic level and was able to articulate a vision of where we needed to go. And the professional activism seemed to funnel people into this very narrow focus where they only looked at one little piece of an issue. And even if they had other interests, they didn't necessarily have the liberty in their job to deal with those other issues going on or the way that their own issue interconnected with so many other things.
Right.
And I think that's part of why it's so fractured in the world of activism. And the people working on one social justice issue don't necessarily know the people working on an issue that might be very intimately connected, and we're missing some of those fundamental connections. And so that's what got me started thinking about it, because I saw that the person that I knew that was kind of closest to doing what I turned out to be good at was Tom Goldsmith, my minister at the First Unitarian Church.
Mm-hmm. Seeing a bigger picture.
Yeah, and having the liberty to deal with whatever issues were out there.
But wait, is it – so I guess divinity school, to my mind, and I'm thinking, so is it then just I'm studying a technique for delivering a message, or is it – Or is it about spirituality and God?
I think it's about studying a foundation of knowledge and understanding and perspective that would lead towards the ministry. Then that foundation that's necessary for the ministry. That's what it is to me. And even as you know, I kind of had that first pragmatic sort of desire to go into the ministry, you know, seeing that that's kind of where I fit.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, and throughout that journey, I was also seeing that that is really what we need at this point, that so many of the obstacles that we're facing and the struggles that we're facing are in large part spiritual struggles. And a lot of where we're falling short, I think, is some sort of spiritual weakness. And the big turning point for me was during my trial. For me, the pinnacle of the whole legal process was what happened during the jury selection in my trial. When the judge and the prosecutor found out that most of the potential jurors had received a pamphlet before they came in on the first day from the Fully Informed Jurors Association. And the pamphlet didn't say anything about my case. It talked about jurors' rights, and it talked about why we have juries. And it told juries that they are supposed to be the conscience of the community,
right,
which was a phrase that came from the Founding Fathers. And when the prosecution found this out, they completely lost it. And we had to go back in the judge's chambers with the judge, the prosecution, my legal team. And it was the only time I saw the prosecutor completely lose his cool. I mean, he was out of his mind. He was screaming. He wanted to get rid of all the potential jurors and get a whole new jury pool, declare a mistrial. And he was almost spitting when he was reading from this pamphlet, saying this notion of voting your conscience is out in space. And he was enraged, and he felt so vulnerable. And that had an impact on me to see somebody in that position be so scared. But then what happened was the judge, rather than dismiss the jury pool, called the jurors in one at a time, the potential jurors. And they were sitting at the end of this long table with the prosecution on one side, me and my legal team on the other, and the judge at the head of the table. And the judge would look across at each potential juror and say, "You understand, it's not your job to decide what's right or wrong. You have to listen to what we say the law says, and you have to enforce it even if you think it's morally wrong. Can you do that? Can you do what I ask you to do, even if you think it's morally wrong?" And, you know, he's this authority figure in kind of a patriarchal position, you know, up above everybody else in the courtroom. And I was sitting in the seat closest to the jurors, and I watched their response. And one after another said, "Yes, I'll do what you tell me to do, even if I think it's morally wrong." And I could tell that they meant it. And that was – that was, to me, the most important experience of this whole thing, because it was when I it was the only time I really understood how some of the great atrocities in history could happen. You know, how like a whole population of people could get behind a tyrannical leader and get behind genocide and things like that when people are willing to let go of their moral authority.
And for the technicality.
For the technicality, and to buy into that explanation that, oh, it's not my job to decide what's right or wrong. I have to listen to what this authority figure says, and I have to do it even if I think it's morally wrong. And when people advocate—
This is Nuremberg trials, right? Right.
Right. When people are letting go of their conscience, you know, I saw that then anything was possible. And, you know, that was the moment that I knew I was going to get convicted, when I watched people let go of their own moral authority and say that they would do whatever the government official told them to do, even if they thought it was morally wrong. And yet at the same time, when I was seeing that the power of conscience could lead down that very dark road, when people let go of their own conscience, I also saw this official, this U.S. attorney who was representing the United States of America, feel completely vulnerable to the notion of citizens using their conscience when they were exercising their civic duties. That they're, you know, I saw the most powerful institution in the world quiver at the very thought of citizens using their conscience. And so I saw these two extremes hinging on the power of conscience, that, you know, that any atrocity was possible if normal people let go of their conscience, and yet no power or institution was safe from citizens exercising their conscience. That any power could be changed or undermined when people held on to their own moral authority and used their conscience. And to me, that was really a spiritual issue. That having that faith in our own moral authority. And in our shared moral authority, that to me is a spiritual thing. And if most people in our society, if you know those 12 out of 12 people were all willing to let go of their moral authority in the face of a government official, that to me is a spiritual failure, a spiritual shortcoming, and one that I think we need to address openly and reconnect people to their own conscience. Give people more faith in their moral authority.
So it's a broad sense of morality, not in a particular God or a series of rules or a behavior that's pious or something like that. It's something – you're seeing something bigger.
Yeah. I mean, I plan to be a Unitarian minister and, you know, Unitarianism is a non-dogmatic religion.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about a certain set of behaviors or certain pious acts. It's about that broader morality and building connections within a religious community.
But you do relate to Jesus as a revolutionary figure, I think is how you put it.
I certainly do. You know, within the Unitarian Church, there are people who have different beliefs about God.
You know,
one of their principles is that not everyone needs to believe the same thing about God in order to be part of the same religious community. So there are people who identify in different ways. You know, personally, I've been on a long spiritual journey. And you know, I do consider myself a Christian, because Jesus has been a powerful example as a revolutionary figure for me. But that's not necessarily a Unitarian precept.
Yeah. It's interesting. Terry Tempest Williams once asked you the difference between tolerance and compassion. And your views on those ideas seem kind of complicated. It seems like you kind of quibble with the definition of tolerance or the way we talk about it. And you worry about compassion in the sense that it could undermine the work to undermine, as you say, justice, injustice and violence. Tolerance and compassion. How are you thinking about those?
Well, I don't remember exactly, you know, what the quote was that you're looking at, but you know, my view on that is that tolerance is not really a goal. I think compassion is a goal.
Hmm.
You know, tolerance is not something that I think we should really be striving for. And in certain situations, we have too much tolerance. You know, tolerance towards injustice is not a positive thing. I think compassion As far as I can reason, I think compassion is always a good thing, but tolerance is not necessarily. Tolerance towards different people, you know, tolerance towards diversity and that kind of thing, is not necessarily a good thing either. It might be better than intolerance, but it's not the same thing as acceptance, and it's certainly not the same thing as valuing diversity.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we should strive for, is actually appreciating the differences, not saying, his differences aren't that big of a deal, so I can overlook them and tolerate this person's differences. But actually appreciate, the different perspectives that diversity can bring to the table.
One thing which sort of leads to something that you had said, I think it was in the Salt Lake Tribune, you had talked about crucial to some of your goals related to environmental activism and climate change was, as you put it, cultivating common ground with the many who believe the path to prosperity requires unfettered fossil fuel extraction. Cultivating common ground. What do you mean by that? Reaching out to – what is that? What is common ground as you're seeing it in that context?
I think what I'm specifically talking about there is common ground with kind of the grassroots across the political spectrum. I don't think the political spectrum is a straight line from left to right. Hmm. I think that's a false dichotomy. I think the political spectrum is more like a very steep pyramid. And usually the people on the bottom of that pyramid, whether they're on the left or the right, have a lot more in common than anyone at the top of that pyramid. Especially in terms of environmental issues, I've never met anyone who doesn't value clean water. I've never met anyone who doesn't value clean air. I've never met anyone who doesn't want to pass on a livable world to our children. And so I think there is a lot of space there for common ground, and for living in a way that is more in line with our values. I think a lot of people in the environmental movement have what I think is a false notion that we need to change people's values, and I don't think we do. We look at the way people consume right now and the way people waste, and we say, oh, we need to change that. But I think, almost anybody that you really sit down with and you get them in an honest moment to talk about what their values are and the things that they really value in their lives, almost everybody is going to be talking about their human relationships. They're going to be talking about how they value their family and their friends and their community. Not many people are going to say that they value their 67-inch TV or their SUV or whatever it may be.
That's the common ground then.
Yeah. And that it's not about shifting people's values. It's about connecting more strongly with our values that we already have.
I wonder, what did you miss out on? I know you missed out on something like the Occupy Wall Street movement, for example. You've kind of felt like, oh, shoot, I kind of missed that. That would have been cool. This is perfect for me. But that's not what I mean. What did you miss out on in the sense of when you were in prison? Again, not saying that your life stopped or anything like that, but if you reflect on the things that you really missed.
I really missed my friends and my community here. That was difficult to be away from them. I did get a lot of visits and a lot of letters and that sort of thing, which certainly helped. But it was certainly challenging to be removed from them. I missed out on the ability to be spontaneous. That's once I was released last week from the halfway house, one of the first things I wanted to do was just take a walk. And not have a certain destination in mind, not have to get it approved a week ahead of time in writing of where I was going and the path that I was going to take and that sort of thing. Just to wander.
Are you going to go out into the wilderness this summer?
Yeah. Yeah, I've got a trip planned down Cataract Canyon. I'll be taking some backpacking and hiking trips. I'll also be taking a canoe trip in the Boundary Waters in Minnesota. So I'll get back out there and get back to what I've missed for the last couple of years.
There's a story that you've told, you've talked about. Was a really transformative moment for you, a conversation you had with Terry Root, the biologist and climate mm-hmm. researcher. This was in March of 2008, where she talked about that in some ways we've blown it. There's no really going back now in terms of the trajectory of climate change. And you've said this. You've said there is no hope really in avoiding some kind of collapse. But you do have a sense of hope about that your generation or a new generation, this is how you put it, can build a better world in the ashes of this one.
Yeah.
Put that in perspective for me, the sense that in some way there is no hope, yet there's nothing but hope.
Well, I think the aspect in which there's no hope is that there's pretty much no hope of any amount of emissions reductions at this point preventing catastrophic climate change. And really what that means is that we are committed at this point to going through a period of extremely rapid change, more rapid change and more drastic change than our civilization has ever experienced before. And I think that's both scary and also a big opportunity. And to me, that makes activism more important than ever because I think it really matters who's steering the ship if we're going through a period of very rapid change. You know, the idea of some kind of collapse when we have a world of ignorant and apathetic citizens who are afraid of their own government and corporate control of everyone's lives, that to me is terrifying. But the idea of extremely rapid change when we have an educated and engaged citizenry that feels like we can direct the course of our own society and hold our government accountable and have corporations subservient to human will, that to me is a big opportunity and the opportunity to learn from some of our previous mistakes as a society. And, you know, so I think it makes the battle much bigger. You know, fighting climate change at this point is not only about reducing emissions. That's still an important goal. But it's also very important that we fight for a just world at the same time, and that we promote human power, that we promote real democratic engagement with our society, and that we fight oppression. You know, as things get worse, as we see more drastic impacts, there's going to be scapegoating, and you know, it's still up in the air of who that scapegoat is going to be. Whether we blame the unions for the lack of growth that we can have anymore, or whether we blame the Mexicans, or whether we blame the Muslims. I think fighting that scapegoating right now is extremely important, because you know, if we allow that kind of scapegoating to happen, that's where things can get really scary in the future. And there'll always be more scapegoats to look for as things get worse and worse. There'll always be a new population of people that we try to target. So I think part of the job for the climate movement now is fighting that scapegoating and focusing on the real reasons of why we're in the situation that we are in, and how we can shape a truly healthy and just world.
We're pretty much out of time, but let me take one more minute
okay. And
ask you, are you worried about a letdown now? I mean, you've been on a kind of high for a while. I mean, last week there was, thunderous ovation at the Tower Theater for, the documentary film, and, you're getting all these high fives and hugs. And I wonder if you worry about there's going to be a sort of a letdown at some point in the near future.
I try to not to let all the wild and fun stuff like hanging out with Neil Young really get to my head too much. I know things will slow down at some point, and I'm kind of looking forward to that. I think that's one of the things that prison probably helped me out with, is experiencing the slow times and how to deal with the letdown times. So I think it's something that I can handle.
Tim DeChristopher. Tim, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombart, Andy Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.